Welcome back, everybody, to Four Winds Fellowships. This is our Bereans Bible Institute. We're in Module 2, where we're discussing the doctrine of God and His Son. This is Section 2C. And in this section, we're dealing with the messenger of Yahweh, or what's usually referred to as the angel of the Lord, who appears many times in the Old Testament using God's name. He's referred to as God, he's referred to as Yahweh, and in some cases, those who see him and interact with him face to face then claim that they have seen God, yet the text is clear that it's Yahweh's messenger who they actually saw and encountered face to face. Now, in this episode, we're going to look at primarily two passages which are understood to be messianic passages. And this is, of course, Isaiah 9, 6, and 7, and Micah chapter 5, verse 2. But we're going to look at the whole context of these two prophecies. Now, one of the things that's important to understand is that Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, and the prophet Micah were contemporaries. They both lived during the reigns of King Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, all kings of Judah. In fact, Isaiah says that his commission to be God's prophet was in the year that King Uzziah died, who was the previous king prior to Jotham. So both prophets prophesied during the reign of these three kings. Both prophets lived in Judah, the southern kingdom. But their prophecies concerned both Judah in the southern kingdom and also Israel in the northern kingdom. Both prophets also prophesied concerning the siege of Jerusalem that was carried out by Sennacherib, king of Assyria. And this occurred during Hezekiah's 14th year of his reign. Apparently, both Isaiah and Micah knew each other. And in fact, one of the interesting points is that Micah actually quotes part of Isaiah, quotes from Isaiah chapter 2, 1 through 4. It's verbatim in Micah chapter 4, verses 1 through 4. So it's obvious that there's overlap between these two prophets, not only in what they prophesied about, but also in their close proximity to each other. The book of Isaiah is a very interesting book. It's sort of divided into two sections. The first 39 chapters parallel the 39 books of the Old Testament, and the last 27 chapters parallel the 27 books of the New Testament, so that Isaiah has 66 chapters, just as the Bible has 66 books. And it's really rather remarkable where this division occurs in chapter 40 of Isaiah, which that chapter begins with a prophecy of John the Baptist and what he was going to preach. So it's really a rather remarkable, you can call it a coincidence, I suppose, but that the book of Isaiah is sort of like a little Bible with both an Old Testament and a New Testament. And also the prophecies about Christ's kingdom and his sufferings are reserved primarily for the latter part, the last 27 chapters of the book of Isaiah. Now, Isaiah is remarkable in that it has sort of this little few chapters sandwiched in the middle, which are not really so much prophetic in nature, but they're historical in nature. And there's a section in Kings and also in Chronicles that actually is derived from Isaiah's prophecy. Isaiah actually gives more detail, however, than we have with these events in either Kings or Chronicles. All right, so let's skip down here to Roman numeral 2. It says here that the Assyrian invasion of Judah and the threat against Hezekiah, king in Jerusalem, took place in Hezekiah's 14th year. That's an important point. We're not going to read a lot of this, the historical portion of this. We'll just sort of skim over it. In Isaiah chapter 36, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, invades Judah, and he sends his chief officer to threaten Hezekiah and Jerusalem, and he mocks Hezekiah's God, Israel's God, Yahweh. In verses 1 through 7, chapter 37, we see that Hezekiah sends Eliakim and Shebna to seek Isaiah's help, his prayers, and his counsel. And so Isaiah sends word back not to fear Sennacherib, that Yahweh will deliver Jerusalem. Well, later we see that Sennacherib's chief officer has a letter delivered to Hezekiah, again, threatening to invade and also, again, mocking Yahweh, the God of Israel. In chapter 37, verses 14 through 20, Hezekiah took the letter to the temple. He spread it before Yahweh and he prayed. And then shortly after that, we read that Isaiah sent a message back to King Hezekiah saying that God had heard his prayer, and he quotes God's words against Sennacherib, promises to defend Jerusalem, saying that the Lord of Sabaoth will do these things. I want to read verses, beginning in verse 20. Excuse me. This is the word that Isaiah sent back to King Hezekiah from God. And he quotes him as this: "Then this shall be a sign for you. You will eat this year what grows of itself, in the second year what springs from the same, and in the third year sow, reap, plant vineyards, and eat their fruit." Of course, he's talking about the sabbatical year, which the seventh sabbatical year, which is followed by the year of Jubilee, and then after that they would return to their normal cycle of gardening. You can read about that sabbatical cycle in Leviticus chapter 25. All right, so God continues. He says, "The surviving remnant of the house of Judah will again take root downward and bear fruit upward. For out of Jerusalem will go forth a remnant, and out of Mount Zion survivors." And this statement is really important. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. The reason that statement is important is because it only appears twice in the Bible, both times in Isaiah, as we will see. "Therefore, thus says the Lord concerning the king of Assyria, he will not come to this city or shoot an arrow there, and he will not come before it with a shield or throw up a siege ramp against it. By the way he came, by the same he will return, and he will not come into this city, declares the Lord. For I will defend this city to save it for my own sake and for my servant David's sake." Now, the picture we have here is that Jerusalem is surrounded by the Assyrian army, and it's a huge, huge army. The Assyrians have conquered many, many, many nations, and they were extraordinarily brutal in their warfare. But what's interesting is what we read in the very next verse. It says, "Then the angel of the Lord," this is Yahweh's messenger, "went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when men arose early in the morning, behold, all these were dead. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and returned home and lived in Nineveh. And it came about, as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, that Adrammelech and Sharezer, his sons, killed him with a sword, and they escaped into the land of Ararat." So what God said, he was going to defend Jerusalem, he was going to preserve Hezekiah's kingdom from this invading army. And so immediately we read after that, that the angel of the Lord struck down almost the entire Assyrian army, 185,000 men that were surrounding Jerusalem. All right, so now why is this incident important? It's important because of the prophecies in both Isaiah and in Micah that deal with this event. All right, so let's go and look at Isaiah's prophecy, written probably decades before these events took place. Let's go back to Isaiah chapter 9. And we have the famous prophecy about Christ. But I'm going to begin reading at the beginning of the chapter, because this prophecy has a context, and the context of the prophecy is this very event, that is Sennacherib's invasion of Judah, and his he was about to slaughter the inhabitants of Jerusalem when the angel of the Lord slaughtered his army. So it starts at the beginning here. Hang on one second, let me just to my place in the notes here. All right, so we're going to read verses 1 through 5. It says, but there will be no more gloom for her who was in anguish. And this is Jerusalem, referred to as a female. In earlier times, he treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt. But later on, he shall make it glorious by way of the sea on the other side of the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. You shall multiply the nation. You shall increase their gladness. They will be glad in your presence as with the gladness of the harvest. Remember, in Isaiah's letter that he sent back to King Hezekiah with the Lord's answer to Hezekiah's prayer, he talked about the fact that they would eat of the previous year's harvest for 2 years, and then they would return to planting and gardening. In other words, God would multiply their harvest, and that's exactly what he did. So it says, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil, for you shall break the yoke of their burden and the staff on their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, as at the battle of Midian. For every boot of the booted warrior in the battle tumult and cloak roiled in blood will be for burning, fuel for fire. Now this is what they did when the angel of the Lord destroyed the camp of the Assyrian army. Now what's interesting about this passage, he says that in verse 4, he says, you will break the yoke of their burden and the staff on their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, who was Sennacherib, as at the battle of Midian. Well, what is the battle of Midian? The battle of Midian is described in Judges chapter 6 and 7. And that's the story of the angel of the Lord who appeared to Gideon and told Gideon to collect an army of men. And he narrowed it down actually to 300 men. And the angel of the Lord defeated the Midianites through Gideon. It's clear that it was the angel of the Lord, the angel of Yahweh, who fought that battle for Gideon by preparing him and his men, and they didn't even have to fight. He completely destroyed the Midianites, who were threatening Israel at the time. So the reason that's important, it says that this overthrow, this relieving Israel from this threat of the oppressor, will be as at the battle of Midian, which was carried out by means of the angel of the Lord. And then it talks about them burning the boots and the cloaks and all that stuff of the Assyrian army. In verse 5, it says, for every boot and booted warrior in the battle tumult, the cloak rolled in blood will be for burning, fuel for the fire. Now, what's really interesting about this is the very next verse, if you read it in its context, places this prophecy, which almost all Christians acknowledge is a prophecy about Christ, places it right in the midst of this scene of this Assyrian invasion during Hezekiah's 14th year. And again, remember, Isaiah is prophesying this sometime before those events actually took place that we read about later in Isaiah 37, 8, and 9. So it says, for a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. Notice that statement. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this, or do these things. That's the exact same statement that's made in Isaiah's reply to Hezekiah while Sennacherib is threatening. God said he's going to take care of this for Hezekiah, not to be concerned that God is going to deliver them. That statement, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this or do these things, the only two times it appears in the Bible is here and in Isaiah 37, where Isaiah's replying to Hezekiah. All right, so that statement connects those two passages there. All right, now, the thing that we have to look at here is there's been a lot of controversy between Jews and Christians about who this child is that's mentioned in verse 6 and 7. There's two main interpretations. Of course, you know the Christian interpretation is that, oh, this is a prophecy that sort of just leaps out of this context where it's talking about the Assyrian army threatening Hezekiah's kingdom, and suddenly we have a prophecy about the birth of Christ, you know, some, 800 years later. It seems to be very out of context. Christians, of course, say that this is a prophecy of the birth of Jesus. Jewish scholars, on the other hand, dispute that, and they dispute it because of the context. The context is clearly the invasion of the southern kingdom during the 14th year of Hezekiah, and the Jewish scholars will acknowledge that, and they point to that. And so where it says that a child is born, they also point to the fact that those verbs are in the past tense, right? It says in your Bible, it says, for unto us a child is born, or in this New American Standard Version, it says, for a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us. But that's not what the Hebrew text says, nor is it what the Septuagint says. In both the Hebrew and the Septuagint, those two statements are in the past tense. It literally says, a youth was begotten for us, a son was given to us. All right, and this, you can see this, I have the Septuagint here on the screen. You can see the words right here, because a youth was begotten for us, a son also was given to us, of whom the beginning, and here it uses in the Septuagint, it uses the Greek word arche, which means beginning. Yes, it can also mean sovereignty, but normally it means the beginning in most cases. If you translate the Septuagint literally, this is what it says: of whom the beginning occurred, past tense, upon his shoulder. His name, and notice name is singular, messenger of great counsel. For I will bring peace upon the rulers, peace and health with him, referring to Hezekiah. His beginning is great, and his peace has no boundary upon the throne of David and his kingdom, to prosper and uphold it with righteousness and with judgment from this time unto the age appointed. The zeal of the Lord of Sabaoth will do these things. Again, that's that statement that's quoted in Isaiah 37. So the Jewish interpretation of this passage is that it has nothing to do with the Messiah. That it's the Jews claim that this passage is talking about King Hezekiah. That, and they point to this fact that he's already begotten. Again, the context is the Assyrian invasion. A youth was begotten for us, a son was given to us. The Jews interpret that as referring to King Hezekiah. And the reason they do is because of verse 7, which talks about him sitting upon the throne of David. And of course, King Hezekiah was sitting upon the throne of David at the time. Of course, there are problems with the Jewish interpretation of this as well, because the kingdom is supposed to continue on unto the age. And Hezekiah only lived 15 more years, if you continue reading in Isaiah chapter 39, right? So, or 38. So it can't refer to Hezekiah himself, yet we've got this apparent conflict here. If you look at the Christian interpretation, we have a prophecy of the birth of Jesus in the context of the Assyrian invasion during Hezekiah's 15th year. But there's another way to look at all of this. And I know this is going to be controversial to present this way. But if you look at the way the Septuagint translates this, where we have these past tense verbs, and you look at the fact that his name, singular, is the messenger of great counsel, according to the Septuagint. And by the way, in the Hebrew, it says his name will be called, you know, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, all these different names, as though it's a series of names. But the fact that the word name is singular, both in the Hebrew and in the Septuagint, means it's a single name. And the way the Jews translate it, it says something, it's actually sort of like a phrase. It's a single name, but it's made up of a phrase. But the way the Septuagint translates it, it's almost certainly referring to the messenger of Yahweh who killed the 185,000 Assyrian soldiers at that particular time. And if you look at it in the context of how Isaiah describes its fulfillment in Isaiah 36, 37, and 38, we see that the youth who was begotten and the son who also was given to us appears to be a reference to the messenger of Yahweh. Now, I know that's going to be very controversial, but keep this in mind. The New Testament never quotes this verse and applies it to Christ. It never does. Now, there are some similarities between verse 7, where it says that, you know, that God's going to give him the throne of David, that he'll be sitting on the throne of David. And there's some similarities between that and what Gabriel said to Mary about Jesus. But it's not a quote from this verse. It's actually, what Gabriel said to Mary is probably quoting from the initial promise that God made to David when he made the Davidic covenant and said that one of his sons is going to sit on his throne and reign over the house of Israel forever. That's primarily what Gabriel was referring to. So you would think that if this passage is a prophecy about the birth of Jesus as a man, you would expect it to be quoted in the New Testament and linked to the birth narratives, but it's not. You know, Matthew and Luke both give an account of Jesus' birth, and Matthew in particular likes to quote prophecy and say, you know, that it was fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophet so-and-so. He does that with Isaiah 7:14, where it talks about a virgin. But in this passage, Matthew does not quote this passage in reference to Christ, nor does Luke. All right, so I just wanted to point that out. It's my belief, and I know, like I said, this is very controversial, of course, but if you look at this in its context, the Assyrian invasion, if you look at it with the fact that it uses past tense verbs in verse 6, meaning the youth was already begotten and the son was already given, in the context of this prophecy being fulfilled, which is the defeat of the Assyrian army by the messenger of Yahweh, who killed 185,000 troops. And in the Septuagint, he's called Yahweh's messenger, or the messenger of great counsel. All of that fits together nicely. However, what doesn't work with that, apparently, is verse 7. Because in verse 7, it says, of whom the beginning occurred on his shoulder. That would refer to Proverbs 8:22, right? Wisdom speaking, the Lord made me the beginning of his way for his works. Christ is called the beginning several times in the New Testament. Here it says, his beginning is great and his peace has no boundary upon the throne of David. This is the problem, upon the throne of David, because this appears to make him the king seated on the throne of David, but that's certainly true of Christ. So if what I'm saying is the correct intent of the prophecy, and I believe it is, what this is doing is it's linking the one who delivered Israel, or delivered the kingdom of Judah, Hezekiah's kingdom, from Sennacherib and his Assyrian army, is being celebrated in this verse, right after the previous verse talked about them burning all the shields and the weapons and the clothes and all that stuff of the slain army of the Assyrians. The very next verse is praising God because of this victory by means of a youth who was begotten, a son who was given. Again, if that's correct, then the messenger of Yahweh who killed 185,000 Assyrians is the messenger of Yahweh. But not only is he the messenger of Yahweh, he's also Yahweh's son. And he was also begotten by Yahweh. All right? All right. So let's skip down here. Also, look at the last part of verse 6. Remember in Isaiah's account of this event, the Assyrian siege of Jerusalem, and then the great deliverance that was brought about, the very next few verses down talks about, in those days Isaiah was sick, nearly died, and he prayed to the Lord, and the Lord answered his prayer. Isaiah tells him that God has heard his prayer and that he's going to give him 15 more years. Well, we see that where it says here, talks about the messenger of great counsel, I will bring peace upon the ruler's peace and health with him. And that him there, I believe, is Hezekiah, because God restored Hezekiah's health at that time. So again, I see these two verses, 6 and 7, as talking about the messenger of Yahweh who defeated the Assyrian army as being prophesied that he is going to be the one bringing peace to David's kingdom and fulfilling the messianic portion of the covenant that God made with David. Now, the only way that could happen is if the messenger of Yahweh became a human being. Oh yeah, that's what the New Testament actually teaches, isn't it? Anyway, let's look at Micah's prophecy. Now, I want to go to Micah chapter 5. You all are familiar with this, I'm sure. This is the famous prophecy about the Messiah coming out of Bethlehem. I want to read, let's start at verse 1, and I want to read several verses here, because I want you to see the context in Micah's prophecy about the one coming forth out of Bethlehem is also set in the same context as Isaiah's prophecy of the deliverance by means of the angel of the Lord delivering Hezekiah's kingdom and the city of Jerusalem from the Assyrian army. So he says, verse 1, I'm reading from the New American Standard. Now muster yourselves in troops, daughter of troops. They have laid siege against us. With a rod they will smite the judge of Israel on the cheek. Sorry. Remember in the letter that was sent to Hezekiah by Sennacherib's chief general, they were mocking the God of Israel. And now Bethlehem is a town, excuse me, just south of Jerusalem. And so when the Assyrian army was attempting to invade and attack surrounding Jerusalem, they were also surrounding Bethlehem. So look what it says here. It says, "But as for you, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you one will go forth for me to be ruler in Israel." Now, of course, that's the Messiah. That's the one who's going to sit on the throne of David and reign over the house of Israel. So he says, out from you, out from Bethlehem, one will go forth. Now, it doesn't say anything about him being born in Bethlehem. All right, that's an assumption that was made later by the Jews. You may remember when the wise men came to Herod, they say, you know, where is this one who was born king of the Jews? And, you know, Herod takes counsel with the Jewish scholars, and they say that, he's going to be born in Bethlehem. And they quote verse 2. They quote part of verse 2. Not all of it, all right? But that was their understanding, that verse 2 was talking about the Messiah going forth from Bethlehem. But again, it doesn't say he will be born there, all right? So it says, "But as for you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you one will go forth for me to be ruler in Israel." Now, go forth simply means to go out of Bethlehem in order to fulfill what God has planned for him, right? But look at the next line. It says, "His goings forth are from long ago, from days of eternity." Now, eternity is not the correct translation. Most of you probably know that the Hebrew and the Greek do not use a word that means eternity here. In fact, some translations say something along from ancient times, or days from ancient times, something along those lines. All right. So, but anyway, days of eternity. There are no days in eternity past, right? So it has to be obviously talking about time as we know it. That is, since the beginning of the creation is when days began. All right, so the one who's going to go forth from Bethlehem to be the Messiah, the ruler of Israel, it says his goings forth are from long ago, from days of eternity, or literally days of antiquity. What's important about this statement is the phrase goings forth. You might notice that that is plural, and it is plural in the Hebrew, and it is also plural in the Septuagint, his goings forth. It's talking about expeditions. He has gone out on expeditions since long ago, since days of antiquity. Well, who does that apply to? Well, it certainly applies to the messenger of Yahweh, who came from heaven on multiple occasions. He appeared to Moses in the burning bush. Well, before that, he appeared to Hagar, he appeared to Abraham, he appeared to Jacob, and of course with Moses, he appeared in the burning bush. He was the messenger of Yahweh who appeared and spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai. According to Stephen in Acts 7, he is the messenger of Yahweh who led Israel through the wilderness, brought them into Canaan, into the promised land, and he's the one who fought for Joshua and delivered the promised land into the hands of Israel. And so his goings forth, or his expeditions, multiple expeditions have been since ancient times. Well, it's very clear that the person spoken of here is the one who is going to come forth from Bethlehem to be a ruler in Israel. This passage absolutely and clearly links Jesus Christ, the Son of God, to the one who has been going forth since ancient times. And another interesting thing about this is that in the Proverbs 8, where we have the wisdom passage, where wisdom says that the Lord made me the beginning of his way for his works, you know, and he talks about that before he created all these things, he established me. The next verse, 25, says he begets me or begat me. He's there as God's assistant in creating all things. And then it goes on to say that he rejoiced, that God rejoiced. He rejoiced before God in his presence and so forth. It also goes on in the next few verses. Wisdom refers to its or his many exoduses or excursions. It uses the same word, which is actually the word exodus in the plural. In Greek, in the Septuagint, it would be exodoi, which means, this is plural, it means outgoings. Wisdom says the same thing of himself in Proverbs chapter 8. I believe it's, I forget the verse. I thought I put it in here. Maybe I didn't. Anyway, it's in Proverbs 8, around verse 31 or 32, if I remember correctly. Uses the same terminology that we find here of the one whose goings forth are since days of antiquity. All right, so let's continue reading, though, because notice at the beginning of the chapter, he's talking about the siege of Jerusalem in the first few verses. Then suddenly in verse 2, he gives a prophecy about Bethlehem, which was part of the siege, saying that out from Bethlehem is going to go forth the one who is going to be the ruler in Israel. That's the Messiah, the one to sit on the throne of David. But then saying that his goings forth, plural, are from long ago, from days of antiquity, literally is what it says. Then look what it says here. Therefore, he will give them up until the time when she who is in labor has borne a child. And of course, that's talking about Christ's birth. Then the remainder of his brethren will return to the sons of Israel, and he will arise and shepherd his flock. This is after he goes forth out of Bethlehem. In the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they will remain. Now, nobody disputes that this is talking about Jesus. Let's continue. Because at that time he will be great to the ends of the earth. But now notice verse 5. This is critical. This one will be our peace when the Assyrian invades our land, when he tramples on our citadels. Then we will raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 leaders of men. And they will shepherd the land of Assyria with the sword and the land of Nimrod at its entrances. So what's it saying here? The key words are in the beginning of verse 5. This one. Who is this one? This one is the one who goes forth out of Bethlehem, who then will lead will shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord. And his name will be great to the ends of the earth. Of course, he's great among the Gentiles. That's the ends of the earth. That's talking about the gospel going out to all nations. But it says this one, the same one that's prophesied to come forth out of Bethlehem, this one will be our peace when the Assyrian invades our land. And remember, Micah's writing this at about the same time Isaiah made his prophecy in Isaiah chapter 9. And both of them were looking forward quite a few years and prophesying about the Assyrian invasion of Judah. What Micah is saying here essentially is that this one, the one who's prophesied to come out of Bethlehem to be the ruler in Israel, the one who shepherds his flock, this one, the same person, is going to be our peace when the Assyrian invades our land. And the Assyrian was Sennacherib, who invaded their land not too many years after this prophecy and Isaiah's prophecies were made. So both passages, but this one is the clearest, I think, but both passages, if you look at them in their context, both passages are in the context of the Assyrian invasion by Sennacherib. Both of them make a prophecy about Christ ultimately, but both passages connect the angel of the Lord who defeated the Assyrian army with the one who is going to come and sit upon the throne of David and be the fulfillment of the Davidic covenant, the messianic prophecies that were given to David. All right, so now, of course, that's going to raise the question, well, who are these seven shepherds and eight princes that are supposed to spoil the Assyrian kingdom after this deliverance takes place? Well, if you know a little bit about the Assyrian Empire and the history, it wasn't all that long after Sennacherib's army was devastated, and then Sennacherib himself was killed by his sons. It wasn't very long after that that his empire began to fall apart and crumble. And it was because the Assyrians had previously captured all these other nations to build this huge empire. But one by one, because Assyria was in a weakened state, these vassal kingdoms began to rebel against their Assyrian overlords. And one by one, they rebelled, and one by one, they defeated and brought about the total collapse of the Assyrian Empire. One of those was Babylon, was probably the most prominent of the vassal kingdoms of the Assyrian Empire, which rebelled against Assyria. And it was because of Babylon, which had a lot of power, that Assyria finally completely fell, and eventually Babylon took its place. And then we know that, if you continue reading in Kings and Second Chronicles, that the Babylonians eventually came and defeated the southern kingdom, destroyed the temple, and took the Jews, took them captive to Babylon, and they were in captivity for 70 years until God raised up Cyrus to defeat the Babylonians and send the Jews back to their land. All right, so I hope you got something out of that. I hope you, if you look at these two passages, these two famous prophecies about Jesus Christ, and they are both prophecies about Christ, but both of these prophecies connect him within their context, connect him to the angel of the Lord who killed 185,000 of the Assyrian army. And in fact, Micah says specifically that the one who comes out of Bethlehem is the one who will be our peace when the Assyrian invades our land. And the Assyrian invasion took place not that many years after Micah made that prophecy and Isaiah made his prophecy about the son, the youth who was begotten for us, and the son who was given to us, which means the angel of the Lord was the son who was begotten and given to Israel at the time that he delivered them from the Assyrian captivity. And then that one will be the one who reigns on the throne of David as the Messiah. All right. Hope you got something out of all that, and we'll see you next time.